My sporting panel tonight are Jim Tucker from the Courier-Mail. Welcome back, Jim.
And you, Steve. Pleasure to be here.
Michael Blucher, the man whose company, The Third Half, runs the, what is it, the Wayne Carey Brand Erosion Award every now and then?
He sets the benchmark.
Thank you. Welcome back, Michael. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Steve.
And Peter Mears, who was sadly absent this week. Glad to say he's back this week. Peter, a sporting writer, broadcaster and commentator. Peter, welcome back.
Nice to be back, Steve.
Question without notice. Did any of you guys see the Wayne Carey stuff in the weekend or on TV tonight? Any observations to draw?
Oh, I thought it was a big plug for his book.
Yeah.
Refused point blank to read it.
Did you really?
Should have read it, but refused point blank.
You're the guy who's normally forgiving towards sports stars, Michael.
I just think this is a little bit too late, and I think the pain that he causes all the people around. I guess if you look at why that book has been written now, that probably sheds the necessary light on, as far as I'm concerned.
You see it as a public relations exercise
rather than a genuine financially driven. Yeah, I guess, setting the record straight as far as he's concerned. But, when was it? 2002? 7 years ago it was.
Yeah.
So it's a long time coming. And I think motivation, I think, is probably strictly financial, and I'm not going to help.
Jim, did everyone at the sports desk at the Courier-Mail have their noses buried in the book, reading all the juicy, salacious chapters?
Oh, to a degree. I mean, it's not the first tell-all book by a sportsman, so you'd hate to say that they're a dime a dozen, but I guess if he'd written in 2003 or just gone public without a book, you might take it, take more from it.
Okay. Fair enough. Thank you very much for that. We've also, later on this evening, we'll be speaking with an interesting guest, a chap by the name of Dr. Kerry Spackman, who's author of The Winner's Bible, Rewire Your Brain for Change. Kerry's a neuroscientist, and he's adapted some of the findings, the work, the research of neuroscience to rewiring your brain for success. Looking forward to speaking with Kerry a little bit later on. That's not far away. Any of you guys watch or go to the V8 Supercar event, such as it was on the Gold Coast in the weekend?
I didn't go, but I was very alert to it, to the fact that the open wheelers had fallen over. And I've got to say that the people that came out of it as characters, like Ingle just slagging off the bloke that smashed his car, and then Wincup being on a demolition derby mission in the race, according to his race rivals, there just seemed to be a lot of seriously good angles to the racing, a lot of dynamic racing and crashing, and like the vision was great. I just thought the open wheelers, forget them. There was enough in the V8 to satisfy any race goer.
Very popular for a local audience, the V8 supercars, no matter what form they are.
Absolutely, but the original premise of getting something on the Gold Coast was to create an international audience. If you go with this program, you're instantly just refining it to an Australian audience. So I guess Queensland government, the race organisers, have to work out what they want. Do they want a great Gold Coast event for V8s, or do they want to still find a way into the world consciousness?
Michael?
Because my understanding is that the state government invest because of the publicity and the profiling.
The international TV
carriage. Exactly.
Supposedly the international TV audience.
Yeah. Do we know exactly what sort of interest there is television-wise? In the V8 supercars? I mean, it's very much a home run.
Very little, as I understand it. I spoke with John Quiggin, Professor of Economics at UQ, before about it, who follows these sort of public policy things, and he says, look, interestingly enough, that race was virtually invisible, judging by the news coverage he checked out online to see who was talking about it overseas. He said if you compared it with something like the Masters Games in Sydney, things like that got huge international coverage. He said, as a bit mischievously, he said, you'd be better off getting the $11.5 million they put in the car race and trying to poach one of the grand finals, either the NRL grand final from Sydney or the AFL grand, just as a one-off almost, just to try and suck in that. His tongue's slightly in cheek, but he says you would get a better result from one of those things or doing a Masters Games well than you would from supposed international coverage for a car race.
Yeah, but I'm with, pardon me, I'm with Jim, Steve. The personalities that have just emerged in the last 3 or 4 years with V8 supercars has been fantastic. Once upon a time, it was just Holden versus Ford, but now, because there's been some swapping from one group to the other, the the drivers themselves have actually had to go out and create their own personas. And Russell Engel,
well, they already have them. No, yeah, they are. They're not creating. They're real personalities.
Yeah, but I just think it's really come to the fore in the last, you know, 3 or 4 years through the web, and they're all their websites. And I mean, Russell Engel is just a great character, 46-year-old cranky man who just, you know, they call him the enforcer. And I've been fortunate enough to have a couple of laps around his facility with him, and a really great character, and one of the icons of motorsport.
You need a grumpy old man in something like
you
that,
do, don't you? Yeah. Just to mix it up, the
absolutely
young upstarts and pretty boys, and
that's,
you know,
right,
just get him angry.
Peter, did you watch it at all, or did you go?
Not much. I saw bits. I'm not a rev head. Mm-hmm. I think I've said that on this show before. But I had a curious interest in it because of what Jim said, that the open wheelers had disappeared. And I thought, is this event going to fall on its face or not? And I agree with what the boys have said, that it was really well done and it was a success on its own. And as Tony Cochran, the head of the V8 supercars, said, who needs the open wheelers? Let's have a standalone event based on the V8s. I know that they're trying to get international television exposure for Queensland. That's the government's interest in it. And I believe it was shown in New Zealand, so international. But I thought a masterstroke to put the legends on, and blokes like Dick Johnson in his original car. He won Bathurst in 1984, racing against Jim Richards and Colin Bond.
They were probably dying to pull him out of the garage at home, weren't they?
Yeah, well, apparently they were donated. The actual cars were donated by a car nut who's bought those vehicles many years ago and maintained them in pristine condition. And that's one of the great things about the sport, that there are people who are just besotted with it and love to do that sort of thing. Oh, look, it's got a future. And I saw today David Williams will be associated with it next year. And he's a very cluey bloke when it comes to running sport, big sport. And he used to be the Director General of Sport in Queensland. He went over to Scotland and ran Scottish Sport. And he's back in Brisbane, and I see the Premier tonight on the news has co-opted him for next year's event.
A couple of calls from people earlier on this evening, been overseas in London for a few years. They said, look, it's invisible over there. Indy was invisible over in London. And this guy said, look, I had 99 channels of satellite TV, and I look for that sort of event. He said it just wasn't anywhere to be seen. You could watch it online or something, but he said not on the major sport channels over there. You could watch the AFL Grand Final or the NRL Grand Final or the Formula One out of Melbourne, but he said that was it. International coverage-wise, in London, that was it. Everything. Indy just wasn't there.
But Australia generally doesn't get that much coverage in London, does it?
True, true. We might move on, chaps. This is 6:12 ABC Brisbane. It's 19 minutes past 8.
This is ABC Local Radio Queensland.
And ABC Digital. My guests are Jim Tucker from the Courier Mail, Michael Blucher from The Third Half, and Peter Mears, sporting writer and broadcaster. My name's Steve. A group pushing to establish a central Queensland-based National Rugby League club says it hopes to have a team in the 2013 season. Dennis Keefe, who led the Cowboys to the NRL Grand Final in 2005, has been appointed Chief Executive Officer of the group, enlisted to campaign for the team, believing they have a strong case. Give me your gut reaction, chaps. What do you think?
It'll be a hard road to hoe, but probably some people thought that with the Cowboys when they first started, and Dennis Keefe's just the man with his background. He's a very experienced sporting administrator, and he's worked with News Limited. He knows big sport. He did a wonderful job with the Cowboys. They won a premiership, of course. Well, they played in a grand final. They didn't win the premiership. But, you know, I've been to a few functions up there with Dennis Keefe, and it's...
Where did he go wrong with the tie pants?
Well, I don't know, because they used to have the Taipans and the Cowboys at the same functions, and I went to I went to both games in the weekend, and both were sold out. You know, in Townsville, they're the biggest thing you can go to. In North Queensland, and basketball in North Queensland, strange enough, it was exactly like it was in Brisbane in about 1990, but you felt like you were in a time warp because everyone in town wanted to go to the basketball and couldn't get tickets, and there was all this hoopla about the American imports, and just like the old days when we had Leroy Loggins running around here, you know.
They're still catching up, the North Queenslanders, aren't they?
No, it's great to see. And Dennis Keefe, I thought, wonderful administrator and will do a great job. But Central Queensland, I'm not sure if they have the clout to make it in the NRL. It'll be a
you'll
tough
get
road.
You'll get the loyal audience, but the business side of the equation is the difficult one, isn't it?
Well, it's like Tasmania having a team in the AFL, isn't it? Mm. They haven't got the money down there.
Yeah.
Because they come from far and wide, don't they, for Townsville? Yep. They come from Cairns and they come from out west and they come from down south. So working on the same equations, are they going to drive from Mackay? Probably not. It's what is the population of Rocky? That's 65, 70?
I don't know. I don't 72, 70, I think. I don't know. Don't quote me.
I'd back it out, actually. I think in terms of the development of the game, they'd be much better off with a team in Perth, and I know it's been tried before, but that's the direction. They've got to get rid of some of the ones in Sydney, and they've got to make it, broaden it to include, you know, some other fronts.
You've got to be kidding.
Jim Tucker, Perth. Go hard. Oh. Go hard, Jim Tucker.
Go, Jimmy, go.
Just don't hold back.
Giddy up. Perth for rugby league. I mean, that's just the ends of the earth. I mean, rugby league is played in Australia, at Campbelltown, some parts of Sydney, well, Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane. Fantastic sport, but it's not.
Is it played in
not,
Melbourne?
It's not a West Australian code.
I didn't realise they had a homegrown rugby league product in Melbourne, Jim. Like,
Central Queensland, great attributes, but it's gone beyond. Sport's gone beyond people with interest groups with great ideas saying, oh, let's have a team. Like Logan had a good case to have a team in rugby league. They're in that corridor between the Gold Coast and Brisbane. But the ruling body of the sports has to have a blueprint and a plan. I'm a rugby union man, but dare I say the AFL has got this brains trust where they've worked out a map where they're going to put teams, how they're going to fund it, and that's how it has to start. It's got to be centralised and you galvanise people to put the team where the economic drivers work. Where you're going to grow your sport. Like Central Queensland, a fantastic hub, produced so many wonderful players over the years, but no chance in the wide world of ever having an NRL team.
Corporate hub, a lot of blue chip companies located in
Mate, you can go and run the Perth NRL team, mate.
Dennis Keefe says apparently they've got a strong case. What would they need to have? They'd have to have a business plan in place, first of all, that would stack up economically over a reasonable period of time, I'd imagine. And what, 5 years, 10 years?
And a ground that's a bit bigger and better than Brown Park, basically, which would probably hold 10,000 if they're lucky. So they've got to build the venue, build it and they might come. But as the boys have just said, I mean, you'd have people driving hundreds of kilometres to come to the match, and even then you probably wouldn't get a crowd that was worthwhile.
The pitfalls are now very, very well established. So many teams have come in with the grandiose idea of we'll have a team and then we'll get the stadium. So the government comes in, supports them, and there's no stadium. The first 1 or 2 years when they really got the crowd hooked, they haven't got a stadium. Western Force came in. They played at Subiaco, which is a big open AFL-style ground. They've gone to Members Equity Stadium next year, which is a rectangular ground, perfect for rugby. The government in Perth said they built them a rectangular ground. Never did. And that example is repeated over and over again. If Central Queensland are serious, they would have to get the money from a multi from somewhere, build the stadium, and then start talking. But
has Melbourne built their rectangular ground yet? Because they were going
coming
to...
coming online at the earliest part of next year. Over $250 million worth of rectangular purpose-built stadium for Victorian Super 15 team plus the Melbourne Storm. So they've actually got it locked in.
Plus and soccer as well, isn't it?
Soccer, yeah, perfect venue.
And there's a standoff at the moment between the Southern Kings, or whatever they call that South African team, and Melbourne as to whether who's going to get the Super 15 franchise. What do you reckon, Jim?
Oh, but that's just a smoke and mirrors job. The South Africans have to go to the absolute extent, go to arbitration to show the South African people that they're pitching as hard as they can to have a team in the Eastern Cape, which is a very black-orientated area of South Africa. So for development reasons, a perfect fit, but certainly not for Super 15. But government-wise, they have to push the envelope as far as they can. They can't cave in at any point. So it goes to the independent arbitrator, who will be a Kiwi, who will decide it goes to Melbourne. And then South Africa, their administrators go back and say, look, we tried, but we didn't get it up.
The one thing, Steve, I feel, final comment about Dennis Keefe and the Central Queensland NRL team, is that they definitely have the passion. That's the one ingredient that Queenslanders don't lack, whereas the other states don't have the passion when it comes to rugby league. So if they can get the financial clout and the corporate backing and they can build a stadium, there's a lot of ifs. You know, they've got, 4 years to try and do it.
What does it cost to run the North Queensland Cowboys a year? Does anyone know?
Just a player budget. Well, player alone would be I think the salary cap's 3.4. So the turnover of a league club, that's a good question, Steve. Probably about 20 million, I think, would be a turnover. But see, the thing, what you need, your main sources of income for sport are television rights. You're split from the RL or wherever it comes from, Australian cricket, sponsorship. Being another somewhere between 25% and 30%, and then you've got gate takings. And what sort of companies are actually going to really throw their weight behind? I mean, there'll be an enormous number of corporate boxes. I understand that, but there's a lot of small companies that aren't really suited. So
maybe they need to approach a Chinese mineral company or a Chinese mining company or something. They're the only sort of people that have the money in central Queensland.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's got to be identified locally, doesn't it? It's got to be bedded locally.
There could be a mining operation who talked in those big bucks who are going to be there for the long haul, who at the moment have local residents throwing rocks at them because they're degrading the environment or whatever. Do they turn it around by investing these huge bucks in
the Comalco Vipers or something?
Yeah. I mean, that's how some of the very viable teams spring up, is trying to change the public perception, and that'd be their...
We'll get another firepower.
The BHP Billiton Bulldozers. Yeah,
the firepower. We can have another firepower story on our hands.
Jim Tucker from the Courier Mail, Michael Blucher from the Third Half, and Peter Mears, sporting writer, broadcaster and commentator, and my guest. My name's Steve Austin. I want to speak with Kerry Spackman very shortly, but how are the locals feeling about the upcoming World Cup in 2010, the soccer event? How's it looking? Are you hearing much about it?
I mean, the Soccer World Cup, they talk events, the Olympics, the Soccer World Cup. It is just a magnificent event. It galvanises everyone. I can remember, and I say again that I'm not a football soccer person, but I can remember where I was for the 98 final. I can remember where I watched Australia lose to Italy and had an opinion about the tackle that wasn't. I mean, everyone does. It's one of those things. I draw the line of being interested in Australia versus Oman and some of those games. But, I mean, it's a world game that just everyone has a heritage in another country, and it's amazing. Just you go down to Lua restaurant down the road in Milton, and the main chef's got Croatian background, so he wears the Croatian shirt during the tournament. I mean, it just gets everyone worked up.
So it is generating some interest.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. It's just like the Olympics as far as I'm concerned, Steve. You know, once every 4 years we pull out our badminton and our archery and our diving and our gymnastics hats and we sit there and we watch it. But blow me down. I'm just refuse point blank to watch the A-League. But like most of Australia, we'll buy into the Socceroos in a World Cup campaign. It's, you know, it's a thing that prods the nationalistic, you know,
Because it's Australia versus
it is, and you know it jabs us in the heart and go let's support
the Aussies,
the national team.
Peter.
Oh, look, I watch the A-League occasionally, and I can't believe the up-and-down nature of that tournament. Did you see Wellington beat the Gold Coast 6-0 over the weekend? And Gold Coast were second top team.
Didn't see that.
They were going to go through undefeated, weren't they?
Yeah, at the beginning of the season, they were raving about them. They've got Clive Palmer behind them, and they've got
one of the
incredible
Mirren
Blyberg as their coach. They're a real personality team. And they got flogged 6-0, but I suppose that's the nature of the competition. But getting back to the World Cup, I mean, I remember the last one. I went down to Park Road and they actually closed it off for the live coverage of when Australia played Italy. And I watched it on the big screens down there. And you couldn't move. It was like when the Olympics was being announced. You know, it was just a wonderful event to be involved with. And all the Italians had their scarves and their singing and... You know, the Aussies were singing, and of course we got robbed, so there was a bit of emotion involved. Well, no, it's a fantastic event.
Is that when you left your mobile phone down there, or is that another time?
No, that was another time.
I'll tell you what I did in the World Cup final. I took my two boys, Nick and Sam, down to Park Road because I knew the Italian festivities would be fairly enormous. And there was a group of Italian guys in the shirts, and they had a plaster of Paris World Cup, which had been painted in gold, and the boys went up and held it and thought it was a real World Cup. But
that was your remake trophy?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it is so bigger than big, isn't it? I mean, I didn't know how big soccer was till I actually went to the Olympics and called soccer in Barcelona, and I couldn't believe it. I mean, the stadium held 120,000 and was full for the final, and this was under 23. This isn't even the big time. And they have a chapel in the dressing room. I mean, it is so big. It's the only game in town in Europe when you go over there. They don't give a hoot about rugby league or AFL or anything, really. So, yeah, look, bring on the World Cup and the Aussies will be there, which is even more interesting.
My sporting paddle will be talking about the other cup worth talking about, the Melbourne Cup, in just a moment.
G'day, Tony Delroy. The mix of teenage hormones, a developing brain and drugs and alcohol can be incredibly weird. But if your child is discovering risk-taking behaviour, how can you go about having the delicate discussion on the dangers of drinking without causing an epic tantrum? Tonight on The Nightlife, James Pitt from Odyssey House will help you talk to your teen.
Family and relationships on Nightlife on ABC Local Radio Queensland.
Keep listening, because I'll be speaking with Dr. Kerry Spackman with my panel in just a moment. Kerry is the author of The Winner's Bible, Rewire Your Brain for Change. He's a neuroscientist who's applying the science of neuroscience to sport and changing or rewiring the way you think about yourself and your team and your game. The Melbourne Cup, Sporting Bet Australia has rated champion trainer Bart Cummings at $4.50 chance to win his 13th Melbourne Cup at Flemington next Tuesday. Any surprises there?
Well, 42 horses left and six of them are Bart, so that on law of averages, that should be 7-1, should it?
Good odds.
So you're 4.50, and given the fact that he's won it 12 times before, quite remarkable, isn't he? Like, do we line him up there with the absolute legends on the field in Australian sport?
No.
Can we make that comparison? I mean, he is a guy who, you know, hasn't, you know, got a cut forward or, you know, made the century when his team was down. But
on his third knee operation.
How do you line up somebody's contribution like Bart Cummings? It always intrigues me.
He just loves horses and stands beside the track at 5 a.m. and watches them gallop past.
I think Bart's rule over this carnival of racing so far to win the Caulfield Cup, the Cox Plate, it's just thrown all the betting permutations. It's completely put a skew on them. I think the international horses people are just looking past them now, anchoring all their bets with Bart Cummings horses. And I just think it's a fascinating phenomenon that Bart's in his 80s and he's still the master trainer and he's just got everyone focked.
He's unbelievably understated, horses. Isn't he? Every time I see him, he's just incredibly understated. Yeah. It's like, it's just another day, really.
we love Bart. We love it. Jim, have you got a tip so we can just put a scratch through that one? Put a line through it?
Well, I think Viewed would have to be in my top three, absolutely. And Alcopop, they're the two that I'd put in my quinoa.
Is there a science to picking horse names? Well, you mentioned Alcopop there. It's sort of like there's someone there with a hat saying, I need a different name for a horse. Oh, I know. Alcopop.
They have to submit three, don't they?
Do they?
Three or four? I think it's, and then it goes through that long involved process as to how it comes out the other end. But
what about Hoobie Got You? That's a good name.
Well, chaps, let's move on. It's 25 minutes to nine.
This is ABC Local Radio Queensland.
Special guest this evening is Dr. Kerry Spackman, who's the author of The Winner's Bible, Rewire Your Brain for Change. Kerry is a neuroscientist whose approach to tackling problems is apparently designed to help you rise above your natural limits, something he's been helping sporting identities do with great success, apparently. Kerry, good evening to you. Thanks for waiting so patiently.
Good evening. Pleasure to be here.
Kerry, tell me about some of the sporting identities you've helped go beyond their natural limits, if you would, please.
Well, obviously, there's a slight issue with, as you'd call it, patient-client confidentiality, but you'll be aware of quite a few of the Formula One drivers that I've worked with for a number of years and some Olympic champions. And, of course, you're probably aware of the All Blacks. So there's a few people that you may know. But the actual individuals, obviously, I try to keep confidential because that's quite important.
You help them go beyond their natural limits by, in essentially, getting them to, psychologically rewiring the brain. Just give me some basics of neuroscience, first of all. So what's just some basic definitions. What's neuroscience?
Well, I guess neuroscience is the actual science of how the brain constructs reality and how the brain controls your personality. And the key issue there is that how your brain actually works is very different to how most people think it actually works. So your brain isn't one great big computer that has one of you inside there. It's actually got lots of little modules and lots of little independent little personalities and drives, and they all contribute to your overall behavior. And many of those things are hidden from your own awareness. So a scientist understands how those things work and how they combine together.
What are the big drivers? Personality, history, like things that have happened to you in the past? What are the big drivers for how the brain works?
Well, some of those things are absolutely powerful, but a number of other things drive your personality. So if you look back, for example, way back to sort of evolutionary history, parts of your brain have these pre-wired modules to control your behavior. For example, if you hear a loud noise behind you, suddenly you'll jump. You didn't have to learn how to do that. That's a startle reflex because you'll probably have a tiger running up behind you about to eat you. So you jump out of the way because you can't learn from that experience. If you didn't jump, the tiger would have eaten you and lesson over. So there's a lot of pre-wired behaviours that control your personality. Some of them are functional, some of them are historical value, and may not actually help you in modern society.
Gentlemen, question for Kerry. Jim Tucker.
Kerry, I write the rugby union for the Courier Mail. It's fascinated me, the intricacies of the All Blacks. Mm-hmm. I read Anton Oliver's autobiography where he spoke of a moment where he's playing a test overseas and there was an All Black fan at the back of the stand, I think it was in Italy, and the fan waved and gave him a cheery before the game type wave of support. And Anton explained that he didn't wave back, he just sort of remorselessly just moved in his direction. And in his book, he said it wasn't the thing for an All Black to do, to turn around and wave back. And he said in his book that he hated himself for not actually responding to a Kiwi fan overseas. Now, I want perhaps a little bit of an insight into the All Blacks. There's something there where they're not winning World Cups. I think they're in a bit of a straitjacket. How do you see it?
Right. Okay. So you're asking a Kiwi to talk about this here in Australia. you put me on the spot here. First of all, going back to Anton, often when if you're competing at the world class level like these All Blacks are and like your Wallabies do, you're asking these athletes to do truly exceptional things. And I don't think the average person sitting at home watching this on TV actually realizes what these athletes go through, both in terms of the pain, the discipline, and just totally putting their bodies on the line. And so different athletes will have a different way of going about getting themselves in the zone. And, for example, Anton, he may have just sort of shut the world out from him. He may have thought it inappropriate and so on, because he is really, he's going to battle, and in many ways it's almost like a primitive fight for his life. He's fighting for his country. So that's the first thing. With respect to the All Blacks and not winning the World Cup, I think we've been through an interesting development phase, and I suspect that the All Blacks will get through this, and they have some very good people in their team, very good coaches, very good support staff, and I think we've learnt a lot of lessons, and I wouldn't write them off for this current World Cup. I feel they could do reasonably well.
Kerry, it's often been pointed out to me that the haka, which precedes the game itself, is actually a welcome chant. But it's very much like a war cry when it comes to rugby. Was that your doing? Did you help sort of turn that at all psychologically?
No, I'm only involved with the individuals on a one-on-one basis. Okay. So the actual team, that whole psyche of the team is dealt with entirely separately from me. So I work with a particular athlete, one of the All Blacks, that may be referred to me, and my job is then to get the very best out of them. I don't actually do anything on the team side of all.
What does what I imagine the haka does do something for the All Blacks psychologically, though?
Oh, it absolutely must do. I mean, it is a war cry. It is a call to battle. It's a bonding aspect, and it's a great threat to the opposition, and it's also tradition. And, you know, you're asking these athletes to fight for country and fight for the honour of the All Blacks, and that's a great way of crystallising that. It's something very special. Only the All Blacks do it in their particular way, so it's a very unique call to battle.
Michael Blucher.
Yes, Kerry, two questions for me. One, theory that elite athletes are either not particularly bright or incredibly bright. The first one being that they don't think at all, they're very instinctive and they just do what they're trained to do. And then the second one is the other extreme where they're analytical and they can process different levels. Your work, does it apply evenly to both, or where have you had your greatest success, I suppose?
Well, that's a very interesting question. It really is a genuinely interesting question. My experience is when I'm talking with world number ones, twos and threes, almost inevitably, it's surprising how intelligent they are. They haven't got there just by sheer hard work and grunt. That's my experience. Maybe in the old days, 20 years ago, it was possible just to go out there and do your best. But these days, it's so competitive and so professional that every single aspect needs to be taken care of to the most relentless attention to detail. And these people are smart. There's no doubt about it. They analyse everything in great detail. I haven't seen any people may not be academically smart, so there may be people who aren't going to get a PhD, but they would be street smart.
Okay, and the second part of the question was, how does your work compare with the work done by sports psychologists and psychotherapists and so forth? What is the difference?
Yes, I think the main difference, I start from the basic premise that I look at how the actual brain works. I'm not interested in motivating people. All the people I work with are incredibly motivated right from the get-go. So I look at the different modules inside the brain, the different contributions to their performance. So, for example, if I'm in Formula One, we may be looking at very technical aspects of how they perceive motion. We may be working in a simulator to help them increase their performance. We may be looking at fine motor control. So that's a very technical aspects, may even have a lot of mathematics, because originally I was trained as a mathematician prior to this. So that's on one level. So it really, and at the other level, you know, for you take someone like a rugby player, obviously we're not going to do any maths with these people, but it may well be that there are some interesting psychological aspects. The All Blacks call it the deep dive I do with some of their players, and we go into the quite deep aspects of their psyche and work out their really deep drivers so that they can call on these and have these well balanced in the heat of the battle. So
what are they?
Well, this is the tricky part. So for me, every single individual is very different. So there's no general rule. So the first thing I do with an athlete is I get to know absolutely everything in them. I divide them up into four parts. There's their physiology, that's their genes, how their brain is wired, the neurotransmitters that run through their brain, there's their psychology, the thoughts that they have, their history, all the experiences they had, and then finally the fourth pillar is their philosophy, their general view on life. And I look at what's in all of those four pillars, and I try to work out what are the key aspects either enhancing or holding back their performance, and they're very, very different for each athlete. And then the question is then, what tools do you use to fix those things?
This isn't funny. I assume there would be commonalities in what holds an athlete back, but you say they're very different in each person.
Yes, no, very, very different. And the funny thing is I'll often sit down with an athlete and I'll say, Well, I've got no idea where this is going to go. I mean, you know, you're talking with some of the world's top athletes, number one, two or three in the world, and you think, you know, these people are very, very successful. They're very good. They come across incredibly well in an interview, and you think, wow, this is a really well-rounded character. What on earth am I going to be able to do with them? And when I sit down there and I talked with them and I listened through, there's always something there, and it always surprises me. It always surprises them. Then I go away and I think about it, and it may take me a week to work out the solution as to what we need to do. Then we give them the intervention, and usually if I've thought of the right answer, it'll make a dramatic difference pretty much on the spot.
Can you give an explanation of how you, in a sense, reformat someone? I'll try and help out. I used to do martial arts, mm-hmm. and one of the things the instructor used to point out is that if you need to visualize the person who's your target, visualize exactly where they are, what they're doing, and achieving what you're setting out to achieve. Even if you're, in a sense, you have to imagine it and try and picture it in your mind's eye, a successful move. If you'd like to get used to the feeling of using that successful move. And they, as I understood them, they were saying what you're doing is you're reprogramming your brain for success in this particular hold, grab, break, kick, whatever it is in martial arts. Is that similar to what you're talking about?
Well, you've touched on two things here. So first of all, there's the actual mechanical aspect of executing a move. Mm-hmm. And that's controlled by a part of the brain called the cerebellum. And that's completely unconscious, and it's like a library of movements, and that absolutely has to be rehearsed. And you can some certain really neat techniques where you can get the actual programs into that cerebellum better than actual practice. So that's one aspect of it. So science has shown you that if you want to change your golf swing or you want to get your tennis stroke better, there are, obviously you need to practice that, but there are also some specific techniques that will get those programs into your cerebellum in a way that you can use them. The second aspect is how do you actually get a player tuned for success? And if I can just give you a very quick story about a particular All Black. There was this fellow who, very successful All Black, played maybe 60 or 70 tests and had done very, very well, but had lost his motivation. And, you know, because he's been in the battle many, many, many years, and he obviously got a lot of money, and life was all a bit comfortable for him. It turned out that when I talked to him, he'd come from one of the islands out of New Zealand, and I was able to identify what was absolutely core to his soul in terms of his intrinsic values from his cultural heritage, his religious upbringing, and was able to tap into that to give him a whole new lease on life. So that sounds a little bit airy-fairy and wishy-washy, but for him, it was absolutely core to his soul, and was able to tap into that and apply that to his rugby career, and suddenly he had a whole new lease on life again.
Gentlemen, another question for Kerry Speckman.
Kerry, Peter Mears here. Visualise this hypothetical, if you could. I'm standing on the 17th tee at Hope Island, and I'm about to hit what I consider the most difficult shot on the course. It's a 190-metre carry over the water, and there's a stiff southwesterly breeze gusting into my face, and I've just had a double bogey on the previous hole. Now, how can I reprogram my brain as a 16 handicapper so that I feel confident when I'm about to hit that shot, instead of just throwing the ball into the water, which I might as well do because most 90% of the time I hit it into the water? Is there some way we weekend warriors can become better golfers by reading your book?
Well, I've actually got a number of books coming out. So the second book is called The Winner's Bible for Elite Sport, which isn't released yet. And that specifically...
That's clearly you, Peter Mears.
Well, I was hoping
not so. And so what you've asked is addressed in that particular book there. These are the technical aspects of how do you get the most out of your actual sporting performance. Because the original book that I've got out here at the moment is sort of a general purpose one for the average person in the street. So going back to your question, the first thing is, of course, you need to have the tools.
Thanks, Steve. Tonight we're going to have a look.
Not sure what happened then. We lost our Kerry Speckman line and we got Tony Delroy. So I'm not quite sure. We'll find out what's happening in just a moment.
Now in its 75th year, the ABC Cricket Magazine is your complete guide to the summer of cricket. Edited by Jim Maxwell, the latest edition has player profiles, score sheets and previews, plus analysis and opinion of Australia, the West Indies and Pakistan. There's also a chance to win a bat signed by members of the Australian team. The ABC Cricket Magazine, available now from ABC shops, ABC centres, newsagents and online.
This is ABC Local Radio Queensland.
We've definitely lost our line to Melbourne to speaking with Kerry Spackman, so we'll just see how we go, see if we can get it back, and we'll get the answer to Peter Mair's question about solving his golf swing over the water trap.
Lurcher's got the answer, I think.
Well, I couldn't believe you double bogeyed the 16th, the easiest hole on the course, Pete. That's where your trouble started.
I can do that on any hole.
Talking about mathematics and rugby players, though, what he could have done is work with Matt Dunning, who had a shot at field goal when the three-point field goal when his team was 4 points behind with a minute to go.
And the result was?
And he kicked the field goal beautifully and they still lost by a point. So I suggest there's a spot for him in the Wallaby camp.
Jim, you looked pregnant with statement then.
I remember that moment. Matt Dunning, he's made a fantastic comeback from last year. He blew his Achilles when he was propping against England last year on a very shifting turf. I thought he should have got reimbursed with quite a big payout because it was clearly the groundsman had cocked up with turf that wasn't suitable for scrummaging. And he's made it back into the Wallabies for this tour. That's going to be one of the great tours. The Wallabies play Saturday night against the All Blacks in Tokyo and then the Grand Slam possibility after that.
Any chance of them pulling off a five-test Grand Slam, even better than the 84 Wallabies, Jimmy? Or is that?
Oh, I hadn't even thought of that, Mizzy.
Pipe dream.
I've put the dead rubber against the All Blacks in Tokyo in a completely different category. Get that over and done with, and then the real tour starts. I mean, that's what rugby's become. We've got four Bledisloe Cup tests this year. That's too many in my eyes, even for the football I most like to watch. Grand Slam tour. Just hope we win the first three and come to a final in Cardiff and the whole world will be watching.
And it's particularly stupid because having four, because we haven't got it, which means we need to win three to get it back. How are we going to do that?
Your mess is wonderful.
See, I don't need Dr. Kerry.
My sporting panel is Jim Tucker, Michael Blucher and Peter Mears. And it sounds like we've got Kerry Spackman back. Kerry, sorry about that interruption, but you were just about to give Peter the solution to his to his vital hole at Hope Island.
Maybe there is no solution for him, and maybe that's why I was cut off. It was sort of like a divine intervention. I think, you know, there's no simple answer to these things. You need to learn the tools of being able to block these things out, being able to move on, because golf in particular is a game where you don't want conscious thoughts intruding during the action. So there's two stages to elite performance here. One is the analytical approach. You're working out what sort of shot you're going to have, how the wind goes, etc., etc. So quite mathematical. You work it all out. That's the logical part of your brain. And then when you actually get to decide what you want to do, you need to be able to tap into this pre-recorded set of actions that you've stored away in another part of your brain, the cerebellum. Turn off the logical parts because those are slow, clumsy, and will actually interfere with the actual execution of the stroke. And then you need to rely entirely on this ballistic, unconscious action that you've pre-selected. So there's a real art, or it's not actually an art, it's a real science behind how you switch between these different modules of your brain to get that great performance. And the elite athletes do it quite effortlessly.
Use the force, Luke.
It is very much that when you actually come to executing the shot, but you need to work it all out in advance and have that repertoire already stored there.
And so if you come to that hole and say, oh no, this is the hole I always have a problem with, you're actually pre-programming your brain to have a problem with it.
Yes, if you remember back to, if you look at a little baby learning to walk, it's very clumsy and it's very unbalanced. And that's because when a baby learns to walk, it's using logical parts of its brain, conscious parts, to actually control its legs. Once it's worked out how to do that, it gradually moves those actions through to its unconscious parts, the cerebellum and so on, and these things move smoothly and quickly and don't even think about it. And so if you suddenly start to worry about your golf swing, unfortunately, you'll go back to these logical modules and they're slow and imprecise and you'll hit the ball all over the place. So being able to switch between these is really important.
Another question for Kerry Spackman.
So, Kerry, your application would seem to be largely individual. You have a lot more relevant, a lot greater relevance working with individuals than it would be with teams. So individuals in a team, but it would be more individuals.
Absolutely, yes. I'm not a team coach. I don't know anything about that skill at all. My thing is about changing people's behaviour and getting the most out of them, whether it's a drug addict addicted to drugs and needs to get over that, or a businessman who needs to perform better, or a sports person who wants to go from number 5 in the world to number 1 or 2 in the world. Individuals.
Jim Tucker.
Kerry, Richard Hadlee was a very intriguing character in cricket. His very big motivation was always to have his charts and his targets, and inside his cricket coffin he'd always have his his wicket targets for Nottinghamshire and his runs and the double, get the wickets and runs in a county season. How did that work how was Richard's brain using that to advantage?
Well, I've never actually worked with Richard, so it's a little bit speculative. I think various people are driven by different things, and he obviously was a very goal-oriented, very mathematical, target-oriented sort of person, and obviously that worked very well for him. You know, I just can't really comment on that, not having met him and done the deep dive on him. But obviously, I mean, a tremendous athlete. Also, very one thing I have noticed, you know, if you had to ask me, you know, what separates out world number 1, 2s, and 3s from everybody else, and you know, we'll say Richard Hadlee was an exceptionally good cricketer. Number one for me is a relentless attention to detail. They always find more detail. You take Tiger Woods, forever fiddling with this and that and adjusting something there. Same with all the Formula One drivers I've worked with or athletes. They always find more and more detail. The second thing, obviously, is work ethic. And, you know, Michael Schumacher is one of the hardest working athletes I ever saw. And I think Richard Hadlee would be a pretty hard worker as well. So those things. And then the third thing would be an unshakable belief in yourself that you just never give in, no matter what the circumstances. Those three things.
I've got to leave it there for time reasons. Kerry, the Winner's Bible's out now. When is your other series, the general series of books, being released, did you say?
The Elite Sport one comes out next year, probably middle of the year, and then I've got one on philosophy and another one on society, so quite a mixed bag there.
You're a polymath. Kerry Spackman, thank you very much.
Pleasure to be there. Good evening.
Dr. Kerry Spackman is author of The Winner's Bible, Rewire Your Brain for Change. Michael Blucher, Jim Tucker and Peter Mears, thank you to you.
Thanks, Steve.
Cheers. Thanks very much, Steve.
Cheers, Steve.